Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. May it please the Court, I'm Lenore Gann, representing the appellant Stanley Brady. This is a review of a summary judgment, which, as you know, is de novo. There are material facts in dispute. There are conflicts of facts and credibility. There was no hearing, and this should have gone to a jury, and we're here asking this Court to reverse the summary judgment and to order a jury trial in this matter. Mr. Brady was demoted from a supervisory position based on a racially stereotyped accusation. There are two white witnesses who say he did this thing, and Mr. Brady and another African-American who say that he didn't. There are significant reasons to question the
code. Did they say that he didn't?
Mr. Brady and his African-American co-worker say that he did not do this.
I thought the one witness just wouldn't talk about it at all.
At the time she was first interviewed, she said to Ms. Mershon, who was interviewing her, I don't want to make a statement. It would just be my word against two others. And she attempted to avoid giving a statement. When she eventually was told that she had to give a written statement, she said that Mr. Brady had not done anything, had not made any offensive gestures for her, and that she had not experienced any sexual harassment from Mr. Brady.
Is that the same thing as saying that he had not done what he was accused of doing?
I think it very clearly is, especially since those...
That's an interpretation of something that was done, and not a surprising interpretation, because there are a number of people who would not find it offensive. But that's not the question. She didn't deny on his behalf that anything happened.
Your Honor, I think that's a pretty clear denial.
Something happened?
Yes,
or that whatever happened was not offensive. I'm looking at her words. No signs of sexual harassment were shown to me during this brief conversation, nor did Mr. Brady present any offensive actions towards me.
I think that we all can agree that grabbing your crotch in the course of a conversation is an offensive act. And those words, sexual harassment and offensive...
That's not correct. There are some people in certain contexts where you're kidding and playing who would not perceive it. It all depends on the individual.
In that case, Your Honor, it's a jury question as to whether she was denying it. I think that the inference to be drawn
Did
from
Mr. Brady deny it? I don't have any shame in apologizing to anyone for what they may perceive as offensive.
Mr. Lanigan, who interviewed him, testified in deposition that before Mr. Brady left for his trip to Africa, he said to him, I did ask to use the bathroom. I didn't grab my crotch.
And that's the best you have. Not Brady's words... I'm curious now, because I was particularly interested in this, because you're setting this case up as two stark portrayals, one denial and one assertion. And so I went to see your denials, and your denials aren't there.
Mr. Brady didn't give any details in writing, but Mr. Lanigan testified, and it's undisputed that he testified this way. Before Mr. Brady left for Africa, he told me, I did ask to use the bathroom.
From Stanley Brady to Patrick Lanigan. I don't have any shame in apologizing to anyone for what they may perceive as offensive.
Your Honor, I can...
That's in writing.
Yes, Your Honor, but there's no reason to say that his written statement is any different or deserves any different weight than his oral statement, which is much more contemporaneous.
If I've been accused and been demoted, and I've been accused of doing a specific thing, and then I'm forced to write and I write, seems to me the first sentence in my letter is going to be, I did not do what I was accused of doing. That's not in this letter.
I think especially his second letter very clearly does say that. But he also said it clearly to Mr. Lanigan. It's in the record. The exact citation is in my brief. He said, I did ask to use the bathroom. I didn't grab my crotch. That was his more or less contemporaneous statement, because it's the one that he made before he went to Africa.
Okay.
Ms. Garrett, in George against Levitt, in this court, which was 2005, it seems to me we made it pretty clear that that the employer's action in a case like this will not be occasion liability if the employer acted on a reasonable belief in the allegation. So the truth of the allegation is not dispositive. The untruth of the allegation is not dispositive.
I don't believe that this was a reasonable belief, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask you this. In the sergeant-at-arms brief at 24, Brady's deposition is quoted in a statement saying, Brady admitted that Living Good honestly believed Brady had committed the crotch-grabbing incident.
Honestly and reason, that's absolutely correct, Your Honor, but honestly believed and reasonably believed are not the same thing. Mr. Living Good may indeed have honestly believed it.
Well, what about this? Brady, this is the brief again. Brady conceded in his amended complaint that the sergeant-at-arms, quote, believed there was clear and convincing evidence, close quote, that he had harassed the employees.
Again, a reasonable belief or a sincere belief is not necessarily a reasonable belief, and under these circumstances, the belief was not reasonable. It was a very flawed investigation in an atmosphere of racial division. There was no, in Master's words, systematic assessment of credibility of the witnesses.
Wasn't there a separate law firm investigation?
Your Honor, the law firm investigation did in fact take place, but it was after the fact. And there is absolutely nothing in the law firm investigation to indicate that they were aware, as the in-house investigators were, of the cultural racial divide or of the fact that Ms. Sullivan had previously made a false accusation of sexual harassment against another African-American supervisor. There's no indication the law firm knew these things when they made their investigation. The law firm investigation is fundamentally irrelevant to this. If there are facts, and I believe I strongly indicated that there are facts that a reasonable juror could infer discrimination, Mr. Brady's entitled to a reasonable juror.
So anytime there's a disputed sexual harassment allegation and the accused is fired or demoted, and the accused then brings a race discrimination claim, it's automatically a jury question.
No, Your Honor.
I think that's what you're saying.
No, it's not what I'm saying. It depends on the facts. Under the facts of this situation, with a very flawed investigation, where there's a sharp divide in race in the witnesses, where the investigators are not only all of the opposite race, but are known in a culture of racial divide, at least one of them is known to dislike Mr. Brady. It's under these circumstances that there's an allegation.
You're putting a lot on the culture of racial divide in the workplace here.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the background circumstance. But in addition, I'm putting a lot on the way the investigators investigated, which was seriously flawed.
Ms. Gruen, let me take you back to our colloquy on the distinction that you raised between honest belief and reasonable belief. Back to 1996 in our Fishback. Quote, once the employer has articulated a non-discriminatory explanation for its action, the issue is not the correctness or desirability of the reasons offered, but whether the employer honestly believes in the reasons it offers, close quote.
I understand that that is what Fishback says, but this court surely did not mean that an honest belief that is not reasonable is nonetheless an acceptable basis for a decision. If the court doesn't have immediate questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank
May it please the court, my name is Victoria Botvin, and I represent the employing office of the House Sergeant at Arms, Mr. Bill Livingood. Seated with me at council table today is a representative from the Sergeant at Arms office, Mr. Dan Strodel, and counsel for the Office of House Employment Counsel. Members of the court, in conducting its de novo review of this case, this court may look at the same evidence that was presented to the district court. And as such, the evidence demonstrates that Brady cannot make out a prima facie case and cannot establish pretext based on three undisputed facts, any of which standing alone could result in dismissal of this case. Those facts are the following. Number one, Mr. Brady cannot show, with anything other than his own words, that he was meeting his employer's legitimate expectations as a supervisor. In fact, all of the evidence points to the contrary. Two, Brady admitted in his deposition that Mr. Livingood honestly believed that he grabbed himself in front of three subordinate employees. Number three, Brady has never contested the legitimacy of the external independent Roman investigation, which concluded, like the first investigation, that Brady grabbed himself in front of three subordinate employees, and that investigation also concluded that there was no evidence that race played any role in the incident itself or the reporting of the incident.
What did you say? Brady doesn't contest the legitimacy of the second investigation?
It's yes, Your Honor.
He spends quite a bit of time on that.
Actually, Your Honor, he contests the relevancy of it, but he does not contest the legitimacy of it.
Well,
he
I'm has, not sure what you mean by legitimacy. His critique is, besides relevance, is that the first investigation took place against this climate of racial animosity, and that the second investigators were not apprised of that and couldn't really contextualize what they were doing.
Your Honor, actually, there is no evidence on the record of what the investigators were apprised of or not apprised of. And there's no evidence on the record that that second investigation was anything less than fair and impartial. As a matter of fact, Brady's counsel took no depositions of the Relman investigators, asked for no affidavits of the Relman investigators, didn't take any statements or interview the Relman investigators ever. But now they try to argue that it is irrelevant because that is their only means of getting it excluded from this court seeing it.
I don't understand your claim that there's not a prima facie case here. It seems quite clearly there's a prima facie case. What's your basis for saying that?
Your Honor, in the cases of George versus Levitt and Schakowsky versus Peters, this court found that in order to establish a prima facie case, an employee must show that he was one of the ways that he may show that is that he was meeting his employer's legitimate expectations as a supervisor. Here, Brady has not presented any evidence that he was meeting his employer's legitimate expectations. And in fact, the evidence points to the contrary. And that evidence includes...
It's only one of the methods. Yeah. I mean, the district court erred on this. We keep sending this back, and the district courts keep erring on it. The prima facie case isn't hard. And we said, in that case, one of the methods. It's not the only method.
Your Honor, correct.
This is such a straightforward prima facie case, it's not even interesting. The district court is completely wrong in its finding here, and there are cases from this circuit that say that.
Your Honor, yes, I understand that the district court did not go far enough in its analysis of the prima facie case, and that is why in a de novo review, this court can look at the same materials that were presented before the district court.
Well, they don't say that there's a prima facie case wasn't made out. It was made out. What we do in a case like this is we continue on, as the Supreme Court told us to do a long time ago in Aikens.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand. The prima facie case, according to Aikens, is one thing that is used as part of the understanding of looking to the issue of pretext.
Well, we have it here. So now,
okay, Your Honor,
prevail under McDonnell Douglas, under the full analysis.
Yes, Your Honor. As Judge Ginsburg pointed out, Brady admitted in his deposition that Mr. Livingood honestly believed he committed the crotch-grabbing incident, that he grabbed himself in front of three subordinate employees.
Well, why would that be dispositive if he could also show that the supervisor had good reason to know, he was honestly believed, but he had checked carefully or looked at the real facts, his honest belief was completely wrong?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand your question.
You can have an honest belief of something that's completely inaccurate, and you might have a responsibility to check to see whether it's right or wrong. Can you just rest on your honest belief?
No, Your Honor, and Mr. Livingood did not rest on his own honest belief here. He, in fact, conducted his own independent investigation of the incident. That investigation included the following. He looked at the four witness statements from all of the individuals who had firsthand knowledge of the event, and in fact, although the two individuals who saw Mr. Brady grab himself give witness statements right away. Ms. Burnett refused several times to give a statement, saying that she wanted to excommunicate herself and did not want to be involved. Yet she acknowledged to Mershon that something happened. In addition, Mr. Livingood waited for Ms. Burnett's statement, and he waited for Mr. Brady to give a statement. Mr. Brady had 4 to 5 days before he left for a vacation to give a statement, yet he refused to give any written details of the incident. And in fact, it is arguable that in his two written statements, at least his first written statement, he did not even deny the incident occurred. He eventually did in his deposition 4 years later, but at the time of the decision making, Mr. Brady had only given verbal denials, and then in his very carefully worded second statement, which he was asked to rewrite specifically because the first statement didn't deny the incident, Ms. Mershon gave him a second chance to submit a written statement, and he said in that written statement, "I, Stanley Brady, did not commit such an offense based on the set of facts given to me by Jean Mershon. I did not commit such an offense toward any employee in the Cannon Garage office on the alleged date." That was only after Mershon told him repeatedly that he had not denied the incident occurred. Mr. Livingood analyzed the four witness statements. He also talked to his deputy, Mr. Don Kelleher. He also consulted employment counsel in making his decision, and he also looked at the Lanigan and the Mershon reports.
Suppose it's just a one-on-one sexual harassment allegation, and the employer chooses to believe the accuser, and then the accused is fired or demoted. Is that enough to prevent, and the accused claims that the accuser is making it up for racial reasons? Okay. Is that enough to get to a jury?
I'm sorry, if I'm following you.
It's a one-on-one claim of sexual harassment. The employer says, well, I don't know who to believe, but I'm going to believe the accuser.
No, Your Honor, that is not enough to get to a jury. And the reason is because this court has repeatedly decided, in fact, in a case that you authored, Jackson versus Gonzalez, and in the case authored by Judge Ginsburg, Fishbach.
Well, that's a qualifications case, but anyway.
No, Your Honor, but the point I'm making is that in both of those cases, the court has repeatedly declined to sit as a super personnel department that second guesses an employer's business decision unless there is an inherently discriminatory motive. Or as in the case of Jackson versus Gonzalez, the weight of the evidence must be inherently indicative of discrimination in order to take that decision away from an employer and put it in the hands of.
I'm just trying to figure out in a racially motivated sexual harassment allegation, follow me so far, whether you can get rid of a case like that on summary judgment, as you seem to suggest here.
Well, Your Honor, I think this court has said repeatedly that it will not take that decision out, even in a racially, I'm sorry, using your words, a racially.
Racially motivated sexual harassment allegation.
Racially motivated sexual harassment allegation, that this court is not going to take that away from an employer and sit as a super personnel department unless it sees something discriminatory about the way that that was handled or investigated.
How about the how about adding to the hypothetical, you have a known employment context in which the racial tensions are very high. They've been very high for a long time. You even fire some supervisors for mishandling your operation. You've done that. And you have an employee who's the accuser who has indicted people inappropriately in the past and probably racially motivated accusations. How about you add that to the context?
Well, Your Honor, that would contribute to a finding of an inference of discrimination. However, unlike the Mastro decision, where the plaintiff was able to demonstrate not only background evidence of discriminatory animus, such as the consent decree or failure to impose discipline on African Americans, but in that case, in the Mastro case, the plaintiff was able to tie that background evidence and tie it directly to the investigation to show at least 5 different ways that that investigation was flawed. Here, although Brady says that the investigation was flawed, he has not pointed to anything specifically about that investigation to show that it was flawed, except...
The one telling thing that he's pointing to is, alleges anyway, that the investigators had no knowledge of the racial context or the racial tensions.
I think that's their argument, Your Honor, on the Roman investigation, not on the internal investigation. They have not pointed to anything on the internal investigation, actually, or the external investigation. Although they say that the investigators had no knowledge of the racial tensions, there is absolutely no evidence on the record to support that. That is pure conclusory statements. And in fact, it is based on pure conclusory statements because they didn't do any discovery about the Roman investigation. So anything that they say about the Roman investigation is purely speculative, conclusory statements, Your Honor.
One of the witnesses here had falsely alleged sexual harassment in the past, isn't that correct?
No, Your Honor. That is, again, a mischaracterization of the testimony. In fact, Sullivan, the employee who complained of the crotch-grabbing incident, although they say that she made a false accusation in the past, in fact, Mr. Livingood described that as not founded. In fact, that allegation had never been investigated.
Not founded?
Not founded, meaning that it had not been investigated.
And why wasn't it investigated?
Yeah, why wasn't it?
Good point, Your Honor. I understand the point. It was not investigated because by the time that allegation was brought to Mr. Livingood's attention, Mr. Morris, the person alleged to have committed the act, was going to be terminated for other reasons. So there was no purpose in investigating it. But to call that claim a false investigation is a complete distortion of...
A false accusation.
Is a distortion of the facts, Your Honor.
Wouldn't an employer want to know it, even if the other employee was going to be fired for other reasons, whether you have someone running around making false accusations?
Your Honor, there were so many other reasons why Morris and at that time Lanigan were going to be fired that it seemed to not be important to investigate that particular allegation because at that time so many employees were making complaints against Mr. Morris and Mr. Lanigan, thus the reason for their termination. Any other questions, Your Honor?
Your time has run, so thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As to the law firm investigation, it's very simple. With facts that can lead to an inference of discrimination, Mr. Brady is entitled to a reasonable jury, not a reasonable law firm. The law firm, Ms. Barr was absolutely right when she says there's no evidence that the law firm knew about the culture of racial hostility or the false allegations. That's right, we don't know what the law firm found. It doesn't matter what the law firm found. Once there are enough facts here to infer discrimination for Mr. Brady to be entitled to a jury.
Well, wait a minute. Why doesn't the law firm's report reflect upon the reasonableness of his view?
I think, this is a question of a jury inference. A jury could infer that it reflects on Mr. Livingood's desire to get it right. It could also infer that Mr. Livingood realized that this looked awfully fishy to Congress. The law firm was asked to do this after Mr. Livingood was approached by members of Congress asking him to take another look at the situation. Finally, I want to stress that there's a real conflict of the facts here. Ms. Botwin represents that Ms. Burnett admitted to Ms. Mershon that something happened. On the other hand, I think her statements can be read to infer precisely the opposite, that she didn't want to get involved. It would be her word against two others, her co-workers on her shift, if she spoke out against them. This is not kind of a systematic investigation of credibility that the court should accept as an adequate reason to deny Mr. Brady a jury trial.
Could you say that again as to how a jury could determine that the employer, Livingood here, didn't have a reasonable belief, notwithstanding the second investigation?
The second investigation, there's no evidence, we don't really know how the second investigation was done. It's true that the plaintiff took no depositions of the second investigators because it's irrelevant. The second investigation certainly makes no mention in its report that it would indicate that it knew in evaluating credibility and evaluating the circumstances. They make no mention of whether there was of the known atmosphere of racial discrimination and hostility there. They make no reference to Ms. Sullivan's prior accusation.
It would be unreasonable for the employer to accept their report as substantiating the charge?
Without having investigated the credibility of the witnesses, yes, I think it is unreasonable.
Well, the first report doesn't evaluate the credibility of the witnesses. It's the second report that does.
But it doesn't give anything that it bases this evaluation of credibility on. They don't say that they don't appear to know, at least they never mentioned it, that she had made a prior false accusation, that she had encouraged Mona Burnett to make a false accusation, that Ms. Burnett felt intimidated. They say it doesn't look to them like there was any racial discrimination, but they don't say why it doesn't look that way. They haven't really looked, they don't indicate that they knew of these facts, which are undisputed.
Suppose an employer has essentially a zero tolerance policy of sexual harassment or sexually suggestive behavior in the workplace, and even a hint of this kind of behavior is going to mean termination or demotion. That doesn't suggest racial discrimination, then.
There might be
a separate problem that you would have with an employer who does that, but is that a problem for an employer to maintain that kind of zero-tolerance policy?
No, I think most sensible people favor a zero-tolerance policy for sexual harassment, but there actually has to be sexual harassment in order for that policy
to be reasonable. Situation where there's conflicting evidence, you know, this employer says, well, the benefit's going to go to the accuser, and I'm not going to tolerate this kind of, even a hint of this kind of behavior.
That's not a zero-tolerance policy for sexual harassment. That's a refusal to look at whether sexual harassment took place. A zero-tolerance policy can only be a policy that is based on the truth of the allegations.
It's hard to find the truth.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why we asked this court to send it to a jury.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Barron. Thank you, Ms. Botvin. Case is submitted.